From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Corlott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Welcome to Worldviews. Toyin Falola dropped out of high school to join a post-colonial peasant rebellion in southwest Nigeria. It took the life of his grandfather and became the driving force behind everything he does.
When I was in college, that experience kept coming back. And I said, why will I not be the chronicler of this event?
Rebecca Cruz talks with a man who's been called the grand historian of Africa. But first, Rebecca and I will discuss the story that dominated international news this week, the so-called Panama Papers, and the law firm at the center of the leak.
They've made these sorts of activities fairly easy. This has become, by many regards, kind of a safe haven for hiding funds.
That's all coming up right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlott. Rebecca Cruz, the big news this week, of course, are these Panama Papers. Everyone's talking about it. Lots of reverberations and reactions and responses. But let's just get the facts here. More than 10 million, more like 11 million personal files of the economic dealings of many influential individuals around the world were released anonymously by an anonymous individual, someone. And basically it reveals how they were hiding money using this law firm in Panama that they were leaked from there, sent to journalists, and it's exposed a lot of people, you know, in their financial activity. So another leak, something like WikiLeaks, something like Snowden, although not security related, more economic related. But tell us a little bit more about this and kind of what's been happening, what the reaction and responses have been.
Yeah, like you said, this is the release of these files. This comes from a firm called Mossack Fonseca, and they have been in business, have been very, very successful for about 40 years. So if you think about what Panama looked like 40 years ago, kind of a free-for-all, and they have been able to really kind of develop as the technology has also developed. So they've made these sorts of activities fairly easy. This has become, by many regards, kind of a safe haven for hiding funds so that you don't have to pay taxes back home. Now, there is nothing illegal about having offshore accounts, but some of the pseudo companies that are developed to, if you will, launder or clean some of these accounts or hide them, there is some illegality there. So just as the technology has developed to make this easier and maybe a little bit behind, but the technology is also now becoming available to expose some of these things. And as you mentioned, we saw this in a different avenue or a different vein with WikiLeaks and with the Snowden affair. So the technology helps those people that are trying to perhaps do things we wouldn't want to know about, but it also, when into the right hands, is then exposed. There's a lot of big names that are involved in this, some that we would be really surprised to hear of. There's files that seem to leak Vladimir Putin to $2 billion in offshore funds. The Ukrainian president, who came to office claiming that he was going to clean up corruption and increase transparency. He's also involved with this. Even David Cameron's father looks like he was trying to hide some of these funds. And Gaddafi, as well as some officials from Iran that were on the sanction list for the United States. So that's a little bit surprising as well. And it also exposes some of the folks in the United States, some companies or faux companies that were built in the United States. So we are not off the hook on this. It's really kind of tearing open the offshore account and the economic industry, global industry.
Well, on the one hand, you mentioned how these technologies and these activities and concerned individuals are exposing corruption and illegal activity on the one hand, but it also calls into question the fact that you can't really hide anything anymore. I mean, there are privacy issues at risk here, or are there not? I mean, the fact is these people were breaking the law and acting illegally, but it exposes your own personal activity and what you're doing in, you know, various corners of the world.
Absolutely. The inclination is that they have broken the law, though we'll see how that plays out. But yes, that you do not necessarily have privacy in these realms anymore, and that's what the company is saying. They're focusing on the fact that they were hacked, that their files were released, and that their clients expected some sort of secrecy, and that's how offshore accounts have worked, that there is this expectation of secrecy. And once this becomes public, then you lose clients and you lose the availability to provide the services. So they're really focusing on that side of things. And of course, people in the governments affected and the citizens affected that have lost out on tax revenue, they're focusing on the other side of things.
Well, obviously it's a new story. We'll be paying a lot of attention to it. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for being here.
Thank you.
If you have any questions or comments about this discussion, let us know on social media. You can find this discussion posted on KGOU's Facebook page, and we're on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU. I tweet at Suzette Gorlott. You can also download this show from our website, kgou.org, and subscribe to our podcast. Coming up, Rebecca talks with University of Texas at Austin historian Toyin Falola about his life and work telling the stories of his native Nigeria. I'm Suzette Gorlott, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlott. We're joined this half hour by Toyin Falola. He's a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin and has written more than a dozen books and memoirs of his experiences in post-colonial Nigeria. He spoke with our contributor, Rebecca Cruz.
Dr. Toyin Falola, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much.
Now, you have been given maybe an honorary title as the Grand Historian of Africa, which is quite the title. And I thought maybe we would start today with talking a little bit about your own personal path, your decisions that got you here. And I'm curious why you have chosen to study history. What is it about history that intrigues you and led you in this direction? I understand that you were actually interested in science when you were younger and now find yourself the Grand Historian of Africa.
Thank you. Actually, I was programmed to be a medical doctor.
Oh, a medical doctor.
which I didn't do. As a teenager, I dropped out of high school to join the first major peasant rebellion in post-colonial Africa in southwestern Nigeria, which lasted 2 years. And I just released a memoir by the University of Michigan on that. In the process, many people died, including my grandfather. So when I was in college, that experience kept coming back. And because the people didn't go to school, and I said, why will I not be the chronicler of this event?
Because you had witnessed.
Because I was a participant.
Yes,
I was part of it. And that became the driving force. Mm-hmm. And between then and now, I've never done any topic that I don't have any connection with. So I must be, all the books I write, there's always one connection or another with
it's part of yourself, that the history that you're sharing with the greater audience.
Yes.
Well, that's wonderful. Yeah. And you have released a memoir a couple of years ago, The Mouth Sweeter Than Salt,
yes,
which I love the name. I wonder what that comes from. Why did you choose
that
name?
Well, it's a proverb. It's a Yoruba proverb that you have the capacity as an orator. But bear in mind that capacity is within orality. And what the memoir is, it's a written text. But I try to balance it in the written text, actually use the concept of moonlight stories.
Moonlight stories, okay.
I did that memoir. There are two memoirs now. The one you just invoked covered my childhood years before the age of 12. And then the second one, Counting the Tiger's Teeth, you know, that's impossible. Covers the years when I was 16 and 17.
The time
when
during
I was,
the rebellion.
Yes, during the rebellion. And I'm currently writing another one, The Agony of Friendship.
The Agony of Friendship, and that will cover your...
That will cover, it's my mad book.
Okay.
People who have disappointed me those that have also disappointed.
Well, maybe we'll go back to the early one. You grew up in Nigeria, obviously.
Yes.
What are some of the memories that you share in that beautiful book about your childhood? And I imagine things have changed quite a bit since
then. A lot. And actually, it's about intersections in time, in generation, in tradition, in culture. It covered the period of the 1950s and 60s, the period when the British were packing their luggage to leave the country. So the country was in a flux, and the memoir captured that. Should you, as the British were leaving, should you restore your past and use their past? Should you, if you want to get married, should you take the monogamous or polygamous option? What options were there? Do you need to go to school to make a living? Because the majority of the people who were not going to school, actually, in my elementary school, only two of us went to high school. If you didn't go to school, it wasn't a disadvantage. You would still be successful as a carpenter, plumber, bricklayer. Should you speak your language, you speak English? What kind of food should you eat? Why do you want to eat British food? Which they eventually rejected.
That's Toyin Falola, an historian at the University of Texas at Austin who's written extensively about his native Nigeria. He'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat, the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. We're hearing from Toyin Falola. He's an historian at the University of Texas at Austin and has dedicated his career to studying his native Nigeria. Just before the break, he told our contributor, Rebecca Cruz, about growing up in the country as it transitioned away from British colonialism.
Right, and bringing it up perhaps to the current day, you mentioned that these tensions still exist, and maybe you can explain that. There's the religious kind of aspect, there's an ethnic aspect and a geographic aspect, and then you throw oil into the mix in Nigeria. How does that all play, and how has the last 50, 60 years kind of gotten us to where we are today, where we're hearing stories of an organization like Boko Haram who is maybe taking advantage of these tensions?
Well, the foundation of modern Nigeria, as with the foundation of many African states, lied in colonial encounters. Africans did not say they wanted modern countries of Ghana or Nigeria. They just cobbled them together.
Of course.
And in cobbling them together, they've done severe damages, created states that superimposed on previous nations. Mm-hmm. And the states, up until now, have not become nation states. So all these divisions keep being magnified, religious divisions, ethnic divisions. And then you now have what you also have in the U.S. now, class division, in which a few people benefiting from government, from access to oil money, have become enormously wealthy, leaving behind them the majority of the population in poverty, which is creating its own problem. But these divisions are manifested in various kinds of violence and conflict. In the southeast, the Niger Delta, you have constant rebellions attacking oil companies.
And that is where most of the oil companies
are. Oil
is,
because they are minority population, and they are using their money to run the country, and they are not happy about that. Then you have above them, the Igbo area, a lot of kidnapping. Many of your listeners may not know about this, that kidnapping is a lucrative business in which you just grab one person and you seek ransom. Which has made the place very deadly in terms of negotiations, because they kidnap you and say, go bring 10 million. And then you have in the northeast, Boko Haram, which is the use of Islam to register protest. But it has gotten out of hand, because in the last 10 years, there have been over a million displaced people, so displaced populations. And then you have over 50,000 people have been killed. And the military for 10 years has been unable to check them. And they're just recording a few successes in the last couple of months. It's lingering. But that lingering of Boko Haram is tied to a number of other issues that people don't talk about. Issues of the environment and global warming. People don't talk about that. The area of Lake Chad, the water has been receding. Grains have fallen in short supply. And that has not only increased poverty level, it has accentuated it in three countries, Cameroon, Nigeria, and Niger, and also in Chad Republic. People do not connect this to the impact of the environment.
So it's a resource struggle as well, but there's the resource,
resource
is water.
Struggle. And then there is this struggle of transhumans that people don't talk about. And why they do, why they miss that is just for sheer ignorance. What happens is those colonial boundaries created new notions of citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
Nigerians, Ghanaians. But bear in mind that everywhere, including the U.S., notions of citizenship, those notions are always contested. But complicating the contestation in the case of Africa are what we used to call pastoralists, those who relied on their animals for a living. They develop a different notion of property. In fact, property does not exist in their language. They do not tie themselves down to a specific place. So they just follow grazing and grass. So that's why they are transhumans. They move like the bats. They move like the birds, like migratory birds. So what those boundaries did is to say, look, you can't move anymore. You have to stay in one place. And wherever you have trans-pastoralists where you don't ask them to move, it will always unleash violence because they must move. You find it among the Kalenjin in Kenya, where the Kikuyu took over their grazing land and relocated them elsewhere under more, a lot of violence. Today you have Fulani herdsmen, they call them Fulani herdsmen, in West Africa with AK-47. Because there's no, when you pin them down in one location, they and their cattle will die. Because they follow the environment as grass grows in various places.
So that's part of their culture, but that's also their livelihood.
It's also an economy. But we're not talking about 1,000 people. We're talking about millions of people. So you have a crisis in East Africa over this. You have crisis in the entire West Africa over this. Because part of the people you call Boko Haram, crisis in Jos, not all of them are actually Nigerians. Thousands and thousands of them move from Burkina Faso, from Niger, from other countries to move to Nigeria. They have no postal code, no address. So ultimately, the state began to contract the mediation of economic issues to the police. That's a mistake. You have to contract that mediation to development. Because if you contract the policing of your citizens to the police, the only answer that the citizens will offer you will be violence. they want to fight.
It's powers up for grabs.
Yes. Yeah. They want to fight. So there's so many dimensions of this crisis. But they framed it as Islamic. But it's bigger than that, much, much bigger than that.
And these displaced persons, as you mentioned, particularly from Nigeria, they are displaced within the region, but there's also been patterns of immigration or emigration elsewhere. What do we know about Nigerian immigrants here, either recently or historically?
No, it's very big, actually. The percentage of Africans coming to the U.S. has been increasing.
Because of the violence intentional?
No, just because of so many reasons. Actually, where they're doing that violence, they don't migrate there. Part of the mythologies in migration is that it's a consequence of poverty. That's not what the data says. It is people with resources who
have
migrate.
The money to leave.
Yes. Okay.
And very interesting, that dichotomy between the wealthy that leave and the poor that migrate but stay internally or in that region.
There's a myth that the migration, that the bulk of it is to the West. That's not correct. 2 million Egyptians migrate every year to Arab countries, other Arab countries. Internal migration within Africa is much, much higher, actually. You find after 1994, the collapse of apartheid, millions of people in southern Africa, Malawi, Lesotho, Zimbabwe, they live in Pretoria, Durban, Johannesburg, which has unleashed some xenophobia in that part of the world. You have a lot of internal movement within West Africa. If I'm Yoruba, you can go to Accra and speak Yoruba on the streets because there's so many Nigerians there. And Nigeria is has displaced the UK as Ghana's second trading partner. And you have people going as far as Gambia. Nigerians going to Fernando Po, Sao Tome, Central Africa. So, but we tend to overlook the extensive nature of that internal migrations in Africa. Boutros Ghali, who died recently, when he lost the bid for the second term as UN General Secretary, created an Afro-Arab summit, and he was gracious to include me as a member, in which, as we began to notice these trends in larger number, oil-rich countries, Qatar, Dubai, Libya, they rely on thousands and thousands of migrant workers, Palestinians, Eritreans, people from the Sahara Desert. And there were no mechanisms in place to protect them or grant them citizenship. But these are millions of number. Qatar, if you're a Qatarian citizen, they give you a check, you don't have to work. Dubai, they can give you a check. So, but they need domestic servants, they need people to clean their streets. And they're able to recruit Palestinians and people from other, or the case of Gaddafi, building his formidable army on migrants, avoiding Libyans themselves to maintain his power base.
Absolutely, and I have witnessed that personally in Dubai, for sure. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, but thank you so, so much for sharing your personal experiences with us.
It's been a pleasure, and I hope to come back some other time.
Well, we hope to have you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Rebecca Cruz's conversation with Toyin Falola. He's a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, who studies and writes about colonial and modern Africa. You can find out more on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews as part of a partnership with the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Sam Dupre produces the show, and Miranda Wilson researches our interviews, which are edited by our digital producer, Brian Hardzinski. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Guerlat.